Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. We're in the XAP directory, which are applications that depend on X. So it's a little bit surprising maybe that we've got a lib package. Yes, libnma. We thought we were done with libs, but we're not. Libnma is a package in the XAP directory. This is a library, obviously lib. Library for developers who are creating password entry dialogues for network manager clients. So if you've ever used the VPN plugin for network manager, you've seen sort of the results of libnma. It has functions like nma underscore vpn underscore password underscore dialog underscore new. And that, as you can imagine, produces a, or is, you know, part of what you would need to produce a little dialog, a little pop-up box that intakes a password and passes that password on to network manager. There are lots of other functions. It's not just for VPN. It could be for any dialogue or any connection requiring further information from the user. But this is the toolkit that a developer could use to develop those dialogue boxes when authoring, you know, some kind of plugin for network manager. It's pretty well documented, I mean, in terms of, like, you know, all the different functions and calls that you can make. So just take a look at the documentation if you're going to be using it. But even its documentation eventually, or quickly rather, refers you to GitLab, GNOME, or GitLab, yeah, what is it? GitLab.gnome.org. That's where they're doing all the development. And so the most up-to-date information on libnma is located there. Okay, next up is Mozilla Firefox. Firefox is a big deal. It started out simply enough, I guess. Netscape Navigator was one of the early web browsers that captured popular attention when the internet was still becoming more or less an everyday technology. I mean, it wasn't everyday yet. It was becoming, you know, it was getting picked up by people. And back in 1998, so Netscape Navigator's big days were before 98. But by 1998, Netscape decided that it would be best to make their web browser open source. And they funded, I'm not sure if they entirely funded or just partly funded, but they threw a bunch of money at a thing called Mozilla Foundation. And they made this foundation the caretaker of this open source code. Development of Netscape Navigator continued for several years, and the product name shifted from, like, Netscape Navigator to Mozilla Browser to eventually Firebird, until finally the community kind of rallied together and settled on Mozilla Firefox. Okay, that's great. But to understand the historical significance here, you kind of have to understand the corporate warfare that got waged over quote-unquote owning the internet. Companies were setting up data centers that invited users to connect and to be online without directly connecting to the World Wide Web. The www dot space wasn't quite solidified yet. It existed, but was that going to be the one that everyone defaulted to? That was the question. And it wasn't a foregone conclusion. Like, there were companies where you could, they would send you essentially an invite code, and this was in the form of literally a physical CD that they sent to you through the mail blindly. They just sent it to a bunch of people, and you could join their existing sort of remote community. So if you signed up with a company like CompuServe, I think is what it was called, or AOL or whatever, then you were joining an existing system curated by that company. And that can be kind of comforting, right? I mean, you're just ushered in, everything is already set up for you. You kind of have a limited world view, but I mean, everything's been placed there for a reason. But at the end of the day, the really exciting stuff, I think, was just it was happening in the wild west of the World Wide Web, WWW. And to get there, you either had to leave the familiar grounds of your paid service. And I think initially that wasn't even an option. I could be wrong about that. But I think in the very early days of like AOL, that was it. You got to be within AOL. You didn't get to go out to the World Wide Web. I could be wrong about that. But that I think I remember that being a thing. I could be misremembering. But to get out to the WWW, you had to either, escape AOL. I mean, you know, there were ways of doing that, I guess. I mean, for sure, I know there were ways of doing that. I was never on AOL, but I mean, I knew people who were. Or you just, you know, didn't go to AOL at all. You just paid a local internet provider, an internet service provider, ISP, to grant you an IP address at your house so that you could sign on to the World Wide Web. Now, that was a little bit scarier because you needed to configure your computer to work. Well, you needed a modem, but I mean, you needed that for AOL as well. But I mean, the modem required drivers, and then you had to configure your computer to recognize that you were joining the World Wide Web network, you know, the big internet. Like you had to type in your IP address that you got from the ISP and so on. So it became, it was non-trivial for a lot of, for really practically everyone. It was a non-trivial task. Like, getting on the internet was not easy. But once it became clear, and it eventually did, I think, that the World Wide Web was the place everyone was deciding was the real internet, then companies decided that they needed to own the applications people were using to access the internet. So they couldn't build their own little silos, as it turns out, or they couldn't get people to come into those silos, as it turns out. So they figured, well, we better own the browsers that people are using to get onto this crazy World Wide Web thing. And I don't even think there was a business case for that at the time. I don't think that the companies understood or had any rational conception of like what that would do for them. They just knew that they had to have ownership of something because they're companies and that's what they do. And so at the time, the browser was that was it. Like, that was the piece of software that people were downloading and using. So companies wanted to own it. And towards that end, Microsoft eventually released and shipped Internet Explorer with its operating system. So that was a pretty effective play, right? I mean, Internet Explorer comes on most computers that exist in the world at the time. So yes, it became the default internet browser. Like, it's just that's kind of easy. Do the math. 90% of the computers that exist are running this software. Most people are just going to click on that and go to the internet. They're not going to go to getfirefox.org or .com, whatever it was. It might still be, I don't know. Anyway, incredibly, even after that, even after Internet Explorer was released and shipped on every computer that existed practically, Mozilla Firefox was still a hugely popular browser and one of the most influential browsers, even though it was competing with Microsoft. And that's a huge feat for anything. That it's a big deal. Now today, Mozilla Firefox is an important browser because of its independence, just like it was before, really. I mean, not that much has changed. I mean, it's still governed by a foundation rather than a corporation. So if you want an open and free internet, then using Firefox is one way to tangentially support that, I guess. I mean, it's hard to draw a very solid line between, oh, I use Firefox, oh, and we have a free and open internet. Like, that's whether or not you're using Firefox doesn't directly affect sort of regulations and people's behavior and so on. So it's hard to say that that's going to directly influence anything, because it doesn't really, but certainly giving power to a large foundation, or supporting a large foundation like Mozilla Foundation, and showing that foundation and the rest of the world that you value your personal data privacy, and you value the open source code, and you value the flexibility of being able to run this browser in the way that you want to run it with the services that you choose to run within that browser. I mean, that is a big deal. It does make a statement. And Mozilla does a lot for open source, and Firefox is still a very significant sort of force in the world, even though it has taken a back seat at this point to Google Chrome for whatever reason, I can't imagine. And I'm not being sarcastic about that. I honestly have no idea why Google Chrome has beat Firefox in sort of ubiquity. I just don't understand that. But it is a big open source project, and if nothing else, it sets a standard by which other browsers can be judged. In other words, we recognize when Google Chrome does something to risk our personal data privacy, largely because Firefox specifically refuses to do the same thing. So if nothing else, Firefox is kind of the light in the darkness of the proprietary sort of movement of the internet. Now, I use Firefox exclusively in real life. I use it on my PC. I use it on the mobile phone. That's all I use. Most of my favorite features pioneered or popularized, I don't know all the features, if they were actually invented by Firefox or whether they were just popularized, but whatever, they're pretty common now. Like a really simple example, a tabbed interface doesn't seem like a big deal today, right? Your internet browser has tabs. Yeah, of course it does. Believe it or not, that was a huge innovation when Firefox introduced it. Again, I don't know whether they literally invented that concept of tabs in a web browser, but they did it in a way that a lot of people noticed. Like, that was where people saw it and thought, I need that in my browser as well. It was a big, big deal. People cited that as a reason to switch to Firefox. And the feature I use most often today, I would say, are Firefox containers. And I don't know that this is in all browsers, but certainly on Firefox, you can create different identities and assign them to containers. So you create a container and you give it a name, like let's say work and home. Easy enough, right? Now, if you have these two containers running, they don't know about each other. So you can have Firefox open and go to a website and sign in with your work identity, and then go to the home container, go to the same website and sign in with your home identity, and the two, there's no conflict there. Like, there's cookies aren't being shared between those tabs, data is not being sent, tracking data and so on. It's not happening. I don't know how solid those containers are, but it's certainly solid enough that I do that quite regularly. I have several different identities in Firefox, and I use different identities to do different activities, and it's just really nice to know that that data, all the extra data being generated from that activity is contained. It's not getting out into another tab. It's not telling another site what I'm doing over on another site and so on. It is quite nice. So that's the one that I use every day. I mean, easily every day I use that. It's not built in, I don't think. Maybe it is now. I don't know. I think it's an add-on, though. And you can get that at github.com/mozilla/multi-account-containers. It's a great feature. If you're not using Firefox, then you should use Firefox literally for that feature. It's such a nice feature. Okay, next in the list is Mozilla again, but this time Thunderbird. So you don't need to communicate over HTTP or sign into a website just to check your email, really. I know a lot of people do. They use webmail, you open a web browser. It's the one window that you open in the morning and you never close throughout the day. It just stays open. And you've got one tab in there where you're checking your email. You don't have to do that. You can use a separate app to check email, which I do because it keeps me out of a web browser. You know, web browsers are distracting. They can be very distracting. It's easy to open up a web browser to check your email and end up who knows where, watching who knows what kind of video being sold, who knows what kind of useless homeware device. So if you don't have to open a web browser, sometimes it is kind of nice not to open a web browser. And also a separate app can integrate with your system in ways that a web browser cannot or maybe should not. So for instance, I don't mind if my local application running on my computer knows where I keep my cryptography keys or sends me notifications when new mail arrives and so on. And browsers, I know, they can do that. But then again, why should a browser do that? Why grant permission to some remote system to interact with my system if I don't need it to? Interactions between you and a remote computer ought to be minimal for the purposes of both sustainability and trust. It just makes sense to keep things bare minimum. So Mozilla Thunderbird is an email client developed by Mozilla, and it's pretty flexible in layout and configuration. So you can have like previews of incoming messages in a panel, or you can just have your inbox take up the entire window, and then you just see the message when you double click on the subject line. You can have those things, and you can integrate encryption. You can check multiple email accounts, which is great. So if you've got, you know, I definitely have a few different email addresses, some for junk mail, some for just for business transactions, some for personal stuff. So you can check, instead of going to three different websites or four different or five different websites, you can do all of that in one interface. Thunderbird's a good client. I don't use it, admittedly. But that's primarily because I had been using Thunderbird and started thinking that really I ought to start using the KDE branded option, which is Contact or Kmail. So I just figured that I would switch away from Thunderbird very intentionally so that I am familiar with the Plasma desktop default. And it's been fine. Like, I'm not going to say Contact is perfect or Kmail is perfect. Here, in fact, let me go to my Contact window here, and then I'm going to click check mail, and oh look, there's an alert from Dr. Conkey telling me that that something has crashed. I can help them improve by reporting this K crash, but I know if I do that, I'll be it would be rejected as a report because I haven't updated KDE Plasma Desktop lately. So it's so far behind where their current code base is that it wouldn't be worth anybody's time, including mine, to try to fix that, whatever that crash is. I mean, it isn't Kmail crashing. It's Akinadi crashing. And it's fine. You just restart it and then it checks your mail. But that happens pretty regularly at this point for whatever reason. Didn't used to, but now it does. I do, to be fair, have a lot of email archived in that in that thing. And I probably should maybe migrate to Thunderbird at some point, but I probably won't because then I'd have to mess with the format of the email and so on. So yeah, I'm probably on Plasma Desk or on Kmail for the foreseeable future. And even with a quirky crash here and there, I do like partaking in the Plasma sort of desktop ecosystem. So that there's a persuasive argument for me to use that instead of something else like Thunderbird. That having been said, I do like Thunderbird, and anytime I'm able to recommend that to someone, I do, because it is cross-platform, which Kmail, maybe technically it is, but, you know, not really. Like, Thunderbird has native clients for lots of different platforms. It's a great little client. It's a lot better than the alternatives. And the alternatives are, for me, like Webmail and Outlook, right? Those are the two big alternatives to Thunderbird. Thunderbird is a lot better than both of those options, especially in like professional environments. It just makes sense to have dedicated email clients at work. It really does. You shouldn't be working out of a web browser at work for email that could feasibly need to be passed on to your replacement or someone else on the team at some point. It just makes sense to have those assets locally on the computer in a dedicated client. Personally, I let emails arrive on my mobile phone through a mobile email client, incidentally, but when I check my email on my desktop computer, the email is removed from the server and copied down to my PC. So I see the emails come in, whether or not I'm at my PC, but then the final destination is the PC, so the email messages don't like clutter up my phone. Not that I'm worried about like storage space, but I just don't necessarily want all of my emails on my phone, to be honest. I just don't tend to need that. So yeah, Thunderbird, lots of flexibility on how you set that up. I mean, a heck of a lot more flexibility than a webmail client, which just you basically get just what your provider, what the email service provider chooses to give you. And Thunderbird, you've got a lot of options that you can choose between depending on how you want to run your desktop. Like whatever works best for you, that's available to you with Thunderbird. So highly recommended, frankly. I think if you're not someone who has used an email client, or you're not someone who typically uses it, I encourage you to take another look. Take another look at Thunderbird. It might get you back out of the web browser, and you might like it. You might also like a cup of coffee. I mean, I know I would. Let's go get a cup of coffee. We'll come back, finish up the show. Time for coffee. Coffee has been acquired, and it's a good cup. I got a good cup of coffee this time. No complaints. I made this one in my espresso maker. Add a little bit of hot water to make it an Americano. A little bit of milk. A little bit of cinnamon for the afternoon. Ever since reading Dune, the book Dune, I read it like years and years ago, and I come back to it every, I don't know, 3 years or so. Ever since reading that and learning that melange, the spice, tastes a little bit like cinnamon, and that they have that in their coffee, I get a hankering for just a sprinkle of cinnamon on coffee, and then I imagine that I'm on Arrakis. It's a fun trick. You should try it. Network Manager Applet is the next package. This is a GUI front end for Network Manager. You may or may not see this on a daily basis on Slackware. It kind of depends on what desktop you're using. So this is the icon that you would click, you know, that sitting in your system tray to bring up like network information, like what network interfaces you have available to you. And there's a setting application called nm-connection-editor where you can choose, you know, what to connect to and maybe do some configuration or something. My point is that's not what you get on the Plasma desktop, which is what I'm running. You're using like, I don't know, probably the KDE or K Network Manager applet or something. I'm not really sure what you're using. I forget. But it's not the same thing. NM applet, or rather network-manager-applet, which on your system is NM-applet, that's the one that you're going to see in, for instance, XFCE, or maybe if you've set up your own environment with Fluxbox or Blackbox or FVWM or any of the other options that Slackware provides, or that you've provided yourself, if you're resourceful. If you've set up your own environment, you could call the KDE Network Manager applet if you wanted to, but also, instead, you could do nm-applet, and that would provide you a nice little minimal menu. When you click on the little arrows, it'll give you a list of the wireless networks or the wired networks, if those are there, and even a VPN option, like everything that, you know, it's Network Manager, so it's got everything that you would expect. So it's quite nice. That's network-manager-applet. Next up is Pan, P-A-N. This is a news reader, or like a Usenet application. I've talked about Usenet and accidentally posted to one in previous episodes, and this is the GUI version of that. This isn't a terminal-based application. This happens in a dedicated client, so I guess we could think of Pan as kind of the Thunderbird of Usenet, maybe. Although I'll bet you anything, Thunderbird used to have Usenet. I think it did. I think I almost remember that. But again, I have no experience with Usenet. I have no nostalgia for it. I barely understand what it is. But Even so, Pan is pretty straightforward, actually. You launch it, you go to the Edit menu and select Edit News Servers, and you add a valid Usenet service. Now, I've been using eternal-september.org over port 563 in my examples, in my like trials and tests, because they have a $0 basic tier where you can join and get, like, I don't know, I guess maybe community contributed Usenet posts or something. I don't really know what you're like, why it's different, but you can get like just some really basic Usenet posts for free for $0. And that's good because most of Usenet these days appears to be like a paid service. So you can't just access them for nothing. So the $0 service at eternal-september.org happens to not be very exciting. Not much activity seems to happen there. But if you do want to experience Usenet, then eternal-september.org and Pan is a pretty darn easy way and $0 way to get started. So once you've added a server, the list of news groups available on that server gets populated in the left column, and you can click on any one of those to see the posts within each group. With Pan, when you click on one, it asks you how many days back you want to download. I have like 33 days in my client, and there are just barely any posts, really. It just, I don't know how far back I'd have to go, but apparently there's not enough activity in most groups to really give meaningful results within a 30-day time span. Again, not terribly active, apparently. So if I was a news group user, I could imagine that this would be a client that I would consider using. It seems like a really nice app. It's really, really intuitive, like, honestly. Like, I guess I probably could have figured out, well, I guess I did figure out news group stuff without this. But I was using Pan a lot as well when I was doing the other terminal-based applications. So I don't know, this just makes it really, this feels pretty intuitive to me. Like, this is nice. I don't need it in my life. I don't need Usenet as far as I know still. But if I did decide that that's something I wanted to do, I think Pan would definitely be on my list. Okay, next up is Pavu Control. This is Pulse Audio Control, P-A-V-U, I guess maybe, what is that? Pulse Audio Volume Control? I don't know. Pavu Control. I don't like how Pulse Audio applications tend to just use the PA abbreviation. I would much rather them just say, like, Pulse Cuddle or something like that. Like, I don't like PA as the shorthand. Because if you don't know to look for PA, then you don't know to look for the thing. It took me ages to find Pavu Control back when I finally did find it. I kicked myself because it was there all along and I just didn't know because it didn't have the word pulse or audio in it. I just can't stand it. So angry. Pulse Audio Control. Anyway, if you need to adjust volumes and change your settings, audio settings outside the volume mixer already provided to you by your desktop, then Pavu Control provides a pretty robust interface to your computer's complete sound system. And I mean, that includes stuff you don't even want to know about, like dummy inputs or graphic card outputs that maybe you're not using or whatever. I mean, it's a really good interface. Aside from the name, there's really no problem with this application. It's really nice. I would definitely use it in Fluxbox or something that doesn't provide its own audio UI. Plasma Desktop happens to do a good job of giving me the audio adjustment tools I need, so I don't actually use Pavu Control often here, but I've used it in the past on other systems. I quite appreciate it. It's worth saying, too, that Pavu Control is a tabbed interface. Somehow, it took me a while to realize that. Like, I don't know why, I just didn't notice them, but along the top, there's a series of tabs for playback, recording, output devices, input devices, and configuration. So use those tabs if you're using Pavu Control, because it is really, really annoying when you're sitting there adjusting a volume slider for playback, wondering why your recording volume isn't being affected. You know, it's just it can be confusing. It's sometimes, I don't know. I think I expected like the categories to be along the side, kind of like on a KDE application. Like there's a column on the left and that determines what shows up on the right. But this was a tabbed interface, so the categories are along the top, and that just confused me. So just remember the tabs should you use Pavu control. Let's talk about Pidgin. That's P-I-D-G-I-N. It's a graphical chat client, and its goal is to take a bunch of protocols and handle them transparently so that you only have to deal with a single interface. This is kind of the holy grail, I think, of chat, and I can't believe that this has been a problem that has been so persistent. You'd think after decades of chat, someone would have realized it's just better to have a single protocol that everyone can use, or at least an open protocol that everyone can tap into. It doesn't have to be a single protocol, but at least an open protocol so that the client doesn't matter. I mean, it's the same problem as Mozilla Firefox, Mozilla Thunderbird. These are you want to be able to have a client that works for you. And when a company tries to grab hold of a protocol and bind it to exactly one client, that's not going to work for somebody, you know, even if it's just an accessibility issue. Like, it's definitely not, never mind convenience, like it's just not going to work for everyone. So Pidgin is really doing a lot of heavy work here. And with libpurple, apparently that's the magical library that makes it all possible. I don't know why, but libpurple has a bunch of plugins. That's probably why it makes it so possible, because it's plugin based. But by default, it's a paltry list. You get Gadu, don't know what that is. Google Talk, I don't even think that exists anymore. GroupWise, IRC, okay, I know that one. Simple, don't know what that is. XMPP, that's Jabber, essentially, and Zephyr. I mean, I've heard of, like, literally, like, I think two of those, well, three, but one I don't think exists anymore. So by default, it might be a little bit underwhelming, but if you go to pidgin.im, like pidgin.instantmessage.im, pidgin.im, then you'll find that there are a bunch of plugins available for Pidgin. I do wish that the plugins were a little easier to install. I mean, right now you end up going to a GitHub page, and then you have to download the thing and issue, like, make and make install commands, and that just doesn't seem as easy as it could be. I think that could use a little bit of work for usability, but at least they exist. So you can get, for instance, Signal. You can get Signal messages within Pidgin. You can get Steam chat within Pidgin. You can get, lots of other protocols just within Pidgin. The setup often is not super easy, even for the, you know, so not only have you had to figure out how to install this plugin, but now you've got to configure it too. And that's not Pidgin's fault, but a lot of chat applications these days, rightly so, require some kind of two-factor authentication. But for whatever reason, they also require weird, API keys and things like that to kind of like to go behind the scenes, to go through a non sort of standard way of signing in. So it becomes this exercise of just going to your chat platform one last time and turning on developer access and getting an API key and then using that. It's so painful. It's so silly. I don't know why we're doing it this way. Pidgin is trying its best to mitigate this so that you don't have 12 different chat applications across various clients and websites open every day. It's just so painful. I have not consolidated into Pidgin. I had tried, I think, at one point to consolidate to Copete or something like that, and it was working, but then there were some features that just didn't seem to translate between the company-sanctioned chat client and whatever I was using, and so I fell off. So I'm kind of back to having basically just one chat thing for work and then one chat thing for personal, although technically it's more like two chat things for personal. It's a drag. It's horrible. Society needs to fix the chat issue, but I don't see it happening because it hasn't happened. As I've said before, I think the closest we got was when Jabber got adopted for those couple of years by Google. And because everyone was using Gmail anyway, everyone was accidentally using Jabber. And so you could just talk to everyone you knew over Jabber, and they would never know that you weren't on Gmail and that you were actually talking to them through Pigeon or Copete or, you know, whatever Jabber client you wanted. That was great. That was the golden age of chat. Next up is rDesktop. It's an RDP, that's Remote Desktop Protocol client. I guess a little like free RDP. If I say that charitably, I mean, they both claim to do RDP. rDesktop, I couldn't actually get to work as expected. Now, first of all, there's no mention of what kind of RDP server needs to be running for rDesktop to work. Like, if you read the documentation, I couldn't find how to get the server started. So that's, and once again, I double checked in /rc.d/rc.rdp. No, it doesn't, it's not there. So I don't know what you're supposed to run on your remote machine to make rDesktop work. And maybe, again, just like free RDP, maybe Windows computers just have RDP running. And so the expectation is that you would use rDesktop from Linux to RDP over to your Windows machine. And you wouldn't have to think about what server you're talking to, because obviously it's the Windows server. Whatever. So maybe that's why. I don't know. In the end, I launched free rdp-shadow-cli, which from the free RDP experiment in, what, two episodes ago or so, I knew would do a server, would do an RDP server. And interestingly, I was ostensibly able to connect to my virtual machine running free rdp-shadow-cli with the command rdesktop-u bogus-p bogus123192.168.122.882. But there was no viewer. There was no view screen. So I was connected, I guess, because it didn't say I wasn't. It didn't give me a prompt back, but I couldn't see anything. I couldn't see what I was connected to. So I don't know if maybe there was another maybe there's another option I was supposed to be using to see what I was connecting to, or maybe I'm supposed to connect to the RDP session or the rDesktop session with another application. I'm not really sure. I couldn't figure that part out. Actually, you know what? Really quick, I'm going to look to make sure I didn't miss some kind of graphical component. No, it's just rDesktop. Yeah. So I don't know. I couldn't get it to work. And then I tried again with free RDP and it just worked. I will note as well that in my research, I noticed that rDesktop's latest release was in 2019. That's 5 years ago, which, hey, that's fine. I don't care. But combined with the website saying that rDesktop needs a new maintainer, I'm thinking that maybe free RDP is just kind of the way to go, at least for now, maybe until rDesktop kind of reinvigorates itself or something, or maybe I'm just missing something super obvious and it's perfectly fine. I don't know. Either way, I'm really not going to use either of them. I just don't have a need for RDP in my life, and I don't anticipate on needing it, so I'm probably not going to use either of them anytime soon, so I'm not too worried about it. Okay, so let's talk about RxVT. I've talked about this before, especially when I was talking about Xterm, if I recall correctly. Look, I'm a fan of Console. I use it a lot. I use it every day. That's the Plasma desktop, the KDE console, the terminal application. It's a nice modern terminal that meets the needs of users who spend their day in a shell and users who only dip into a shell now and again, because it integrates into the desktop environment. It kind of bridges the gap between common GUI tasks like dragging and dropping and common shell tasks. So love it to death. But that said, I quite like the RxVT-Unicode terminal for its simplicity and portability and extensibility, which I've mentioned before when we were talking about X defaults. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First, maybe the obvious one is that it's really, really lightweight. Like, rxvt-unicode. I'm just going to say rxvt, but technically it's rxvt-unicode because it does have some patch in its code to allow for Unicode. So rxvt is very lightweight. And one of my sort of personal budgeting tricks, and, you know, arguably contributions to the environment of our planet, is to repair and reuse. So I don't really love to buy new hardware. I mean, I have purchased new hardware sometimes, like components for my PC. I frequently buy new because that's kind of the point. A Steam Deck, I bought that new. I didn't buy that used. But for laptops and things like that, I very, very frequently rescue usable computers for use at home, and sometimes at work, frankly. And it's a great little system. It saves on money, and like I say, it kind of saves on resources as well. But one of the things about that, as you may well know if you're one of those dumpster divers, is that the older computers, they have sort of, you have to budget your resources a little bit differently. So if you're running some kind of lightweight Linux distribution on your laptop that you've rescued from a dumpster or something, one of the things you don't want to do is use up all of its CPU power and RAM, which is probably limited, on a terminal. It just doesn't make sense. But RxVT, I mean, it's not a very heavy application. You're not using a bunch of resources when you're running RxVT. It's a lightweight, very basic interface, but it's great still. And I'll talk about, again, why it's great. Another reason why I use it, though, why I enjoy using it. Like I say, I also use console, but another reason I enjoy using RxVT is because it is distinct. So this is in contrast, direct contrast to console. One of the reasons I love console, that where console blurs the distinction between, you know, the modern desktop, like dragging and dropping. RxVT does not do that. So RxVT, you can't drag and drop a file into RxVT and have the path get pasted in. It just doesn't, that's not something that works on RxVT. It knows exactly what it is, and that is a terminal. It is a text-based interface to your computer. And I kind of sometimes like that. I mean, it's not a must have, obviously, because I do use console, and I love dragging and dropping things into console. It's super great. But sometimes it's kind of nice to have a terminal that is a true terminal. Not that console isn't a true terminal, but I mean, it kind of forces you, RxVT does it, it forces you to think about how a terminal works and like what that interface actually is. And in other words, in console, for instance, there are several times where I'll just be lazy and I'll type, you know, CD or you know, CP or something, and then I'll open up the Dolphin. I'll go to the file that I want to like copy or open or whatever I'm doing, and I'll drag it over to console. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's my point, right? Console is nice. It's got a lot of conveniences, but it also doesn't. That doesn't force me to develop tricks and clever ways to be lazy. That's just the cop-out lazy. That's just the easy, lazy way to be with console. But with RxVT, you don't have that option. So you're going to have to type in that path. Now what are you going to do about that? You going to just use tab completion? Maybe. Or you could use a lot of asterisks. You know, you know that it's in your documents directory, and well, you have documents and downloads, so you can get away with the DO, maybe C, and then an asterisk, okay? And then is it the only file of its type in your documents folder? Well, then just do an asterisk again. You know, so you develop like these really simple sort of lazy things that you do in a terminal because it's a terminal and you have no other option. Whereas on console or on GNOME terminal or whatever, you're less likely to come up with those clever little workarounds. And that may not matter mostly. Like most days, that doesn't matter because you do have console, you do have GNOME terminal, whatever. But when you don't, then suddenly you're like, oh yeah, I get it. I'm in bare bone terminal mode. And then you're, you know, it's because you're on some old computer or on a really, really rough connection, and all you're trying to do is just get those letters to type in and appear on your screen so you can press return. And then suddenly those little tricks that maybe you wouldn't have thought of if you were just used to only the cool, easy, lazy stuff, those tricks really, really help. And I really, really like that. Another benefit of RxVT, I reckon, is its configuration, which I've already talked about, so I won't go too deep into here, but it uses xDefaults, which, I don't necessarily love xDefaults, but I mean, it is a text file. And there's something about a plain text file, as any Linux user will tell you. They're easy to port to other computers, they're easy to back up, they're easy to commit to a Git repo if you're managing your .dot files through Git. You know, it's really nice. I mean, I'm not saying that console doesn't have good configuration options. I'm just saying that sometimes it's just really nice where everything is in a plain text file. Because it is xDefaults, you have to do this weird xrdb-merge.xDefaults command in order for everything to update, but it is quite nice. And there's, like I say, there's a lot of options there. You can define colors, urxvt.color0, urxvt.color16, or no, 15, sorry, 0 to 15 to 16. urxvt*background, you can set that. You can do font definitions, urxvt*font:xft:whatever font you want at whatever size, and anti-aliasing true or false. You can customize the scroll bar if your RxVT scroll bar, if you're not loving the old XFT look, you can do like urxvt.scrollStyle:plain, urxvt.scrollBar_right:true. That moves your scroll bar over to the right instead of the left, and so on. There's a bunch of properties that are listed in the RxVT manual, or you can do urxvt --help. Easy. Cool thing about RxVT as well. You probably don't. You may not know this, dear listener, if you've never spent a lot of time with RxVT. I mean, or any time, then you definitely don't know this. But you know how in a lot of terminals, you can copy text or paste text with Control Shift C or V respectively. Because if you just do Control C in a terminal, and that just cancels the process, the on, you know, whatever process. Well, no process is happening, so it just keeps giving you a new prompt. But if you do Control Shift C or whatever, then in many terminals that copies something, or Control Shift V, that'll paste something. That doesn't work in urxvt or rxvt-unicode. That doesn't work. So you might think, well, that seems kind of impossible. How am I ever going to copy or paste something? Don't worry, you can do it. You just don't realize you can do it. So if you select something in your RxVT terminal and then hit Control right click and hold, you do have to hold that right click, you get a little contextual menu including copy selection to keyboard to clipboard. And then if you hit Control right click again, paste clipboard selection, it pastes that text in. So rather than Control Shift C or Control Shift V, just use Control right click in the terminal, and you get all kinds of cool options. And you'd never know it was there. I don't even remember how I discovered that, honestly. Probably the man page, maybe. I don't know. There's another somewhat hidden menu in RxVT. You control middle click for some common options. Just little things like whether or not you want a visual bell or the cursor to blink, to see what locale your terminal is set to right now, and so on. So you do have a little bit of a extra sort of visual cue there, and that's kind of nice. So RxVT, it's just a nice basic terminal. That's really my best argument for it. That's why I keep going back to it. Just to remove, the excess. Just kind of get back to the basics, and that's refreshing sometimes, potentially. Depends on what you're doing. Sometimes it's not refreshing. Sometimes you just want it to be really easy. You just want to drag and drop stuff or whatever, you know, control shift V to paste or whatever. But other times, yeah, maybe you don't. Maybe you want something a little bit more basic for whatever reason. Okay, finally, for this episode, last one, SANE, S-A-N-E, stands for Scanner Access Now Easy. It is meant to be an all-encompassing API for Linux users to access a flatbed scanner, or a camera, like an image import device. This package ships with a couple of different binaries. It's got SANE find scanner, SANE-find-scanner, which confirms, you know, which helps you confirm ideally that a device is detected or connected and detected. It's got a configuration utility so you can adjust gamma, a rudimentary scan application called xscanimage, and a few other binaries, along with a list of configuration files that are specific to scanner brands, which you don't really probably need to you know interact with yourself. But I mean, they're there. They're helping your scanner sort of have reasonable defaults and so on. So you're probably using SANE whether you know it or not. I mean, if you've got a flatbed scanner, you're probably using SANE. Personally, I don't use xScanimage, the little application, myself. I have Scan Lite from KDE applications, so that's what I use. It's a very sort of modern feeling, kind of robust little scanning thing where you can, you know, it auto detects specific regions that you might want to scan. You can override that or select new ones or whatever you want to do. You can set resolution and all that other stuff. So Scan Lite, I highly recommend. But xScanimage, I mean, it is there, it does work. You launch it, you get a basic interface that basically allows you to name the file that it's going to create when you scan, and you can choose the scan mode, such as color or grayscale. Mine, for whatever reason, defaulted to gray, don't know why. And then you can scan, or you can open a preview window, which is what I would think you would want to do. I mean, unless you're just really, really confident in what you've got on the flatbed scanner. I don't know. I like to see these things before I commit them to file personally, but whatever. So the preview window just shows you it's a little white window. You click the acquire preview button, and it does a quick scan and shows you what that image is going to look like once you save it to your drive. And that is, as far as I can tell, all the preview window does. There's not a whole lot going on with that. You can't sort of predefine sub regions that you want it to scan. It just really does seem to be a preview of the thing on the scanner. If you like what you see, then you can click scan in the main window, and that'll save the image to your hard drive or, you know, wherever you're saving it to. The package also contains a bunch of libraries that are useful for specific brands of scanners. I want to say that these libraries are used by other things, but I could be wrong about that. Either way, you can try xScanimage out if you want. I recommend ScanLite. I think that's a more modern feeling application, but then again, like, maybe you don't need that. Maybe it's fine to just use xScanimage. Maybe that's all you need. So yeah, it's up to you. There are options here. And maybe, you know, if you're not running Plasma Desktop, maybe ScanLite seems a little bit heavy for you. Maybe that's overkill. Who knows? xScanimage exists. It's in the SANE package. It's on your machine. That's it for this episode, I think. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.